fleeting glimpses of things seen through a veil, darkly. Do we understand the meaning of these visions of life? Why we are here and how little of our existence we truly understand? Tonight we will talk of these things on The Other Side. Welcome to the program. I'm Jim Harold, so glad to be with you. And if you followed me for any time at all, you know what we're going to cover today is my favorite topic in all kind of metaphysical paranormal studies, because it deals with the afterlife. And as I often say, we might not all see a ghost. We might not all see a UFO. We may not all see a cryptid creature. But we are going to, regardless of our belief, have to go through this process of physical death. And the question is, what, if anything, lies beyond? And we've got a great person to speak about that today with. I'm talking about Daniel Drayson. He is no award-winning documentary filmmaker and has been a photographer and media producer for more than six decades. Now, since the early 1990s, as featured in his documentary Calling Earth, Daniel has been actively investigating the field of afterlife communication through traditional mental and physical mediumship, as well as modern electronics. And he has a recent book out. It is called A New Science of the Afterlife, Space, Time, and the Consciousness Code. And he's calling in today from the San Francisco Bay Area. We're so glad to speak with him. Daniel, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Jim. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So as I read that bio, it mentioned how in the early 90s, you really kind of locked onto this afterlife topic. Why did you decide at that point this is something that you really wanted to pursue?
Well, I've been involved in what you might call paranormal investigation for most of my life. I'm not too fond of the term paranormal.
Fair enough.
For one simple reason, and that is that we don't know what's normal or paranormal if we can't talk about it openly.
Mm-hmm.
Our culture puts brackets around these things and labels on them. And, there are certain social penalties for being too open about one's experiences.
Yes.
And I'm sure that's no news to you. So as a result, we don't really have a handle on what's normal or the limits of what's normal. It's the same as the term supernatural. I get into this in my book, and the longest chapter in the book is actually about language and how language determines how we see things and the values you give to them. So when we say supernatural, we're putting arbitrary limits on the definition of nature that nature never asked for. How do we know what's beyond nature? And, it's all a matter of words. We can define nature as in narrow terms, or we can say, nature is the whole thing,
mm-hmm.
the greater
mm-hmm.
reality, in which case nothing is supernatural.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, death is about as natural as you can get, just as birth is. And then if there is an afterlife, that would be an extension of the natural, then I would think.
Exactly. And if there's a before life, then it's an extension in the other direction. And, we say before and after with reference to our, the time frame of our physical lives, which is pretty short compared to the time frame of the universe. And so the deeper one gets into this, and I'm sure you'll agree, is that the terms before life and afterlife are maybe a bit narrow. And that's why in the book, I tend to use the term the greater reality, which includes our past lives, everyone's past lives, and our current physical life and whatever comes after.
In the book, you tackle the subject of materialism. And then for folks who maybe are newer to these concepts and things, materialism is not talking about, oh, I want to buy that Mercedes. It's talking about the idea that everything we see, everything we experience, our very persons, are just material. We're just matter. There is no soul. There is no consciousness. Everything can be weighed on a scale and measured in a test tube. I don't know if that's a decent definition of it, but just a thumbnail sketch of what materialism is. Could you talk to our folks about what you mean by materialism and why it's maybe a wrong-headed way to kind of look at reality?
Well, I think you touched on it yourself in pointing out about the like buying the Mercedes, because our conception of reality then leads to our value systems, and you know, materialism really has two definitions. One of which is our tendency to value material goods and luxuries, and the means of acquiring them, and sometimes the means themselves become the most important thing. So the two are very much connected. As for materialism as a, I call it a religion, actually, in my book.
Mm-hmm.
It's a belief system.
That, yes.
It's a belief system about reality, and it's almost a planetary belief system at this point. And so looking past the material, I think is, or at least asking questions that point beyond the material are very important. And this is where science comes in, because science at its best is basically organized curiosity. And if we lack curiosity about, you know, looking beyond our current beliefs and our picture of reality, then we're kind of stuck in it. And I think science can, if it steps up to the plate, and it's already begun to do that in the last 30, 40 years, it can provide a window into the greater reality that's not spooky or anything special. It's just really part of reality that we're embedded in and swimming in at all times right now, but we can't see it. And by see, I don't mean necessarily with our physical eyes, but our whole our concepts of reality are so limited that once we begin to extend them a bit by whatever means, it can be through study, through doing one's own scientific experiments, but also by having events occur in one's life that are not explainable in conventional terms. And I've had my share of those, and they were part of what encouraged me to look beyond the normal materialistic concerns of my culture. So I'm sorry, I think I've kind of gotten a little far afield there, but
no,
I hope
fine.
I've answered your question.
No, certainly.
Let me ask you, Jim.
Yes.
What was it in your life that triggered your interest in these other realms?
Well, honestly, it's I always point back to In Search of with Leonard Nimoy when I was in elementary school in the 70s and a 6-7-year-old kid watching those shows. And then a couple of experiences that my family members had. And my family was very working class, very, not really given to flights of fancy necessarily. They wouldn't, you know, get a pyramid and put it under their bed to focus the power of the universe, kind of salt of the earth.
Right.
And they had a couple of stories. One was a ghost story. One was a UFO story that, from the time I was a little kid till my dad is the last surviving member there, but he's 87 and he still tells exactly those same two stories. Yeah. And I think maybe a little bit of Leonard Nimoy and my family's stories kind of work together to make me realize that, you know, I'm a great respecter of science. I mean, what we're doing now, you'll remember, some of our listeners won't, but you used to need to be Ted Koppel with a satellite to do what we're doing right now, right?
Right.
So to me, science makes that possible. It is amazing.
Yep.
So I don't want to disrespect science, but I think like you, there are blind spots, and I think there is a certain religiosity that has taken over, and it's kind of like, well, don't confuse me with the facts or with these possibilities. I know what's right, and that's all that right. The science is settled.
Right. I tend to think of the if I use the term the cult of skepticism, I think you'll know what I mean.
Yeah, sure.
And I think the professional skeptics are among the priesthood of the materialistic religion.
Yeah.
And you'll see them trotted out on TV shows to debunk just about anything.
Well, my big critique of many of those skeptics, and I've interviewed a number of them, Joe Nickel, Ben Radford, Dr. Michael Shermer. Now, Shermer, I will say, he irritates me with his viewpoints, but I appreciate the fact that he would have the conversation. I do appreciate that. And he was a very respectful guy. But the thing is that you'll take a happening and they won't, or an event that is claimed to be, and I'll use the word supernatural, paranormal, out of what,
sure,
you know, out of what we're used to seeing. And they won't specifically look at that event on its own merits. They'll just throw general objections to it.
Right.
You know, the same old objections as always, you know, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, and oh, it's swamp gas, or it's, you know, the hallucinations of a dying mind. When somebody has a near-death experience, for example, and they can come back and report what medical personnel were doing to them while they were dead. For a short time, and they can report back, but somehow that's just the dopamine of a dying mind. That makes no sense to me. That makes no sense to me.
Well, one of the basic tenets of science is don't spout off about things you know nothing about.
Right.
And you know, from reading, you know, what the skeptical choir has to say, most of the time they don't seem to know anything. They seem never to have actually studied all of this whole field of which they're so skeptical, and they're promoting their ignorance in the name of science, which I think is worthy of some satire, actually.
You know? Well, I think that if you go too far in one direction or the other, for example, we do a lot of things about ghosts, and some people mm-hmm. believe everything's a demon or everything's a ghost, and I highly doubt that. And I think that, you know, some skepticism is good. I think reasonable belief is good. I think that you can mm-hmm. swing too far in both directions. I tend to be what I would call a believer. I believe that many of these things are real. That doesn't mean that they're all real. So I like kind of that almost middle ground, but straying towards the belief side. That's kind of where I'm at. But but more importantly, it's where you're at. Now, one thing I want to talk about, you talk about in the book, because unfortunately, because of the popularity, and again, I'll use this phrase, but of the paranormal TV shows and so forth, people think that the only thing that is done in this realm of investigation are a bunch of people walking into an old spooky house with black t-shirts and a bunch of recording gear. That is the full scope of afterlife research. But can you talk about the different things that have gone on and are going on in afterlife research right now that may be way beyond those kind of things that many people are familiar with?
Sure. Well, speaking of having the recorders running, I think one of the most intriguing aspects of not just afterlife research, but afterlife evidence is what's called instrumental transcommunication. And that's a fancy term for communication from the other side through modern electronics. This is a subject of my documentary called Calling Earth, which I reference in my book. And that forms one of the main chapters of the book. It goes back to the 1950s, actually, when tape recorders first became consumer items. And people were, now and then, were hearing voices, faint voices on their tapes that didn't belong there. They couldn't account for them. And generally in the United States, this was dismissed as, well, maybe the machine is picking up some radio station or something like that. And that did happen. It's a phenomenon called radio pickup.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no further inquiry put into it at that time, at least in the U.S. In Europe, things were very different. In Europe, a number of researchers and engineers and physicists got involved and recorded thousands and thousands of these examples of these anomalous voices. And in many instances, they were in dialogue with these folks on the other side who mm-hmm. were communicating through their instruments, which could be tape recorders. And now I know people who are communicating with their deceased children through iPhone apps and memo recorders and so on. We don't understand how it happens, but that doesn't mean it's not happening. But this is another one of the skeptics' favorite ploys. They say, "Well, we don't understand the mechanism of it, so it can't possibly be happening."
Right.
Which is ridiculous, because that's what science is all about: finding out why things happen.
I have to interject.
Sure.
Shermer told me, I said, well, Dr. Shermer, I agree that probably the vast majority of whatever phenomena you're looking at are perfectly explicable. But what about those few percent that, you know, you can't explain, I can't explain. What about those? And he's like, oh, we kind of set those aside. That's what graduate students are for. And it's like, well, wait a minute. That's the percent you need to take down and investigate seriously. But they just kind of, cast them off almost as rounding errors.
Right, exactly.
If it doesn't agree with their worldview, yeah.
Right.
Go ahead,
well, I'm sorry. I agree that Michael Shermer is one of the more accessible and cordial folks in that field. But yeah, it's like a fear of the devil in a way. They seem to be so terrified that something will actually be discovered that's beyond the boundaries of their definition of reality that they have to resort to verbal and conceptual jujitsu to make it seem kosher and scientific. But that really has very little to do with science itself.
Yeah,
skepticism has different, again, like a lot of words that we throw around, skepticism has different meanings. And in the context of a genuine, a bona fide scientific investigation, skepticism is simply, some piece of evidence comes along and you doubt it at first. You don't consider it watertight or ironclad until you have tested it. So the testing phase of any scientific investigation is part of its properly skeptical component. Skepticism has nothing to do with rejection prior to investigation. That's anti-scientific. I think you would agree.
I do agree.
Yeah.
So what I mean, when people come or something is coming through on these recordings, what are there some kind of recurring themes? Is there some kind of point that they try to get across? Is there something, if you did like a content analysis or something, is it something that you would see continue to crop up time after time, some overlying themes?
Well, there are different classes of these communications. For people who are just experimenting, they may get responses that are sort of random comments from the other side. And it's as if one of my favorite metaphors for this process is, imagine two railroad trains on parallel but very squiggly tracks. So sometimes they come together and sometimes they don't. And there's only one open window in each train. And the trick is to throw a spitball between one train and the other at those moments when those two windows line up.
That's how
I see the process, that we don't understand what encourages the process or what impedes it. We know that it happens sometimes, not at all. Sometimes it happens easily. So in many cases, these apparent windows of opportunity are so short that all you get are quick comments. And you'll see some of that in my film. But that's one type of communication. Other type is where people are having a genuine dialogue across the veil, as it were. There's a woman named Vicki Talbot, who you'll see in my film. And she's been communicating with her deceased son for about 20 years now, at least 20 years. And the communications are remarkable. Sometimes they're very short and terse, and sometimes they're more extended. And those communications and others have given us a better and better and better sense of what it's like over there. Now, our language can be deceptive. Over there is not necessarily in some far off realm in the sky. Over there, from my perspective at this point, is simply a higher frequency framework of reality. It's right here. It's right here in our rooms, right here around us, even within our bodies. And this is not such a far out conception. I mean, we know that we're sitting here, thousands of radio broadcasts and wireless communications and TV programs are going through our space at every moment, but they quote don't exist because we can't resonate with them.
Right.
But if we bring in a device that resonates with that frequency, well, all of a sudden it becomes real. Yeah, so I'm saying that what we call the other side isn't over there anyplace. Now, we talk about the veil between our world and the next world, and that's just a metaphor. What is the veil? As far as I'm concerned, the veil is our physical senses, which are tuned only to this very narrow physical slice of reality. When you look at other species, for example, even domestic animals, dogs live in a somewhat different universe. I mean, they're aware of odors around them that give them a huge amounts of information. We're blind to that, right? And that's just a very tiny example. I think that once we vacate our physical bodies, or even simply kind of relax our brains through whether it's psychedelics or meditation or that sort of thing. And by the way, psychedelics allow an expansion of consciousness as a function of diminished cerebral activity, which gives us a hint that the brain is, as some people say, a filtering mechanism that limits our consciousness to a certain focus on the physical. But it doesn't have to, and we can train ourselves to soften those boundaries to a great extent. I was talking to someone yesterday who was with his girlfriend on a psychedelic journey.
Mm-hmm.
And he experienced leaving his body completely. And what ensued was that his body was then being used by his girlfriend's deceased father to bring a message to her.
Oh, wow. Hmm.
That's actually the first instance that I've heard of that sort of thing. But I wonder again how common it might be, whether it's through psychedelics or meditation or, you know, whatever people do to kind of loosen the grip of their physical perceptions, that can induce a form of mediumship.
I have a question for you. I want to throw this out there because just yesterday I have a show called Jim Harold's Campfire where people come on and they share their experiences of things that are outside the norm or things that we consider outside the norm. And a woman was talking about a potential sign from a friend who had passed away. And she said something to the effect of, well, you know, I wish I would have told her, you know, how important she was to me and things. Mm. And I made this comment, and it's certainly not an original thought, but if we believe that our loved ones are around us and can access us, then it makes sense that we can access them. So why not say whatever that thing was out loud, so they can hear it, and even that, because all of us have done that. I think any of us who have lived to a certain age and loved ones have passed, friends, family, whatever it might be, we've said, "Man, I wish I would have told that person this." We've all done it, and I don't.
Yeah.
I think, you know, we got to watch beating ourselves up about those kind of things because that's part of the human condition. Because we always assume, almost always, that person's going to be there tomorrow, and we don't really know.
Yeah.
So, yep.
And I wonder whether we even have to say it out loud.
Good point.
For us, it makes us feel better. It makes us feel the communication is more complete and intentional. I agree.
And I guess my thought was, I think I said this, if I'm wrong and it doesn't work, it still makes you feel better. and if it does work, that's great.
Right. Well, that's almost like what a skeptic would say. Well, do it if it makes you feel better.
That's true. That's true. That's true. No, that's fair. And
it is also true.
And by the way, I sometimes, whether it's, you know, one day I was driving and my mom's been gone for about a little over 10 years, and I've taken over the role of caregiver for my dad. Now he's relatively self-sufficient, but I take him for his groceries and pay his bills and do all that stuff.
Good for you.
And thank you. And I thought, I wonder if I'm doing right. And then in my mind came the voice of my mom saying, I think you're doing a damn good job, Jimmy, which is exactly the way that, because she came from the South. So that's exactly the way she would have said it. But then part of me was like, well, that's just me imagining. Even someone who is a believer, even someone who has been doing these shows for 18 years, even that little skeptic comes in and says, ah, it's just your imagination.
Well, what's imagination? Do we know? Do we understand? Do we understand imagination as something that's purely fluff,
right?
Or is it part of a larger spectrum of perception? Where do we draw the line? You know, between making stuff up on the one hand, and being sensitive and receptive to actual communications. I don't know where to draw that line. We probably need more refined language around this. Because our language is very crude around all this stuff.
Sure.
So that there's a big question mark there for me. I mean, I have had subtle communications from deceased friends and relatives. Some not so subtle as well. My late partner Jane, after she passed in 2007, usually in the evenings, ritual of the day would be to go in the kitchen and do the dishes and clean up. And it was at those quiet moments when I would feel a tingling on the top of my head. Hmm. It was so intense. It was like the top of my head was going to come off. And I knew it was Jane. That was the way she could communicate with me. And this would happen often and repeatedly. On another occasion, I was preparing for bed and was thinking about her and thinking about her and thinking about her. All of a sudden, the clock radio on the night table turns itself on. The clock glows like the sun, lights the whole room up. It had never done this before. The radio goes on for about 3 seconds and then shuts off. Hmm. So I kind of blew her a kiss, and this same thing happened twice more in the next few minutes. And that had not happened before or since with this particular radio. But I'm familiar enough with that kind of phenomenon that I considered it a very sweet little gift.
Yeah.
That's in my book, I get into what I call involuntary mediumship and postmortem pranks. This will involve, for example, lights being switched on and off. It's a very, very common thing that people report.
Mm-hmm.
And when that sort of thing happens to me, and it has happened to me at different times in my life, I'll walk into a room and the lights will start blinking. And I always check it out. I go over to the lamp, I check the bulb and the cord to eliminate any conventional explanation. And I think it's wise to do that, because it's easy to fool ourselves at times. But I've had objects appear and disappear, that sort of thing. And I find it amusing more than anything else.
Yeah. We talked about on this show, I interviewed a few years ago, pre-pandemic, Mary Rose Barrington, who'd been very active in the UK. She was an older woman, and I believe, I know she has passed, but she wrote a book called Jot, just one of those things about disappearing objects that show up in places that they shouldn't. And we've had so many accounts of that on the Campfire Show, of things that had no reason to show up where they show up, but yet they're there. The world works in mysterious ways.
I can show you an object that appeared in my life. Hold on one second.
Sure. And for you who are listening on audio, Daniel is going to show us something, and I'll give you he can give you a description of what it is.
Okay. This is, it's called a Tibetan neck cord. It's a red string with a knot, and it is worn traditionally by Tibetan monks.
Hmm.
And this neck cord showed up in my apartment back in the 1980s, when I lived over in Oakland. I got up one morning and this Tibetan neck cord was draped over the back of my office chair out of nowhere. And the interesting thing about it, and I'll put this in front of the webcam so
I can see it. Yes.
See it. The knot, the knot is almost shiny, which means it's well worn.
Yes.
So how did this neck cord get off the head that had worn it?
Yeah, it seems like some kind of a sign. It's a kind of a reddish-looking cord. Very interesting.
Yeah. So the story I tell myself about it is that this neck cord might have belonged to me in some past life. I mean, I can't prove that, but and that how this cord, which is not large enough to get off a head, how it got off a head, would be a very intriguing speculation. I'm sure that I've had lifetimes of love-hate relationships with various religious and spiritual institutions. So
and that may exhibit.
Who knows?
well, since we're talking about past lives, I mean, I know we're going to go a little long here, but we're having a great conversation. Okay. You talk about the James Leininger case, and I've always been kind of on the fence about reincarnation. But boy, there's some, you know, you look at the work of Ian Stevenson, Dr. Jim B. Tucker at the University of Virginia, and this James Leininger case. Could you kind of give people a little bit of a thumbnail of it who maybe are not familiar? Because that, to me, is one of the most fascinating ones.
Right. James Leininger is this young boy who was born in California. His family lives in one of the southern states now. And he, almost from the time he was born, was obviously a very distressed kid. Before he could talk, but as soon as he could draw, he began drawing pictures of air battles. The age of two, his father took him to an air museum, and young James, again at the age of two, identified a particular World War II fighter aircraft called the Corsair, and explained to his father the features and the shortcomings of that particular airplane.
That's amazing.
Long story short, his parents started doing some research based on the child's apparent memories. And they found that an American pilot by the name of James Houston was shot down in a particular battle near Iwo Jima off in the Sea of Japan toward the end of the Second World War. Young James remembered the name of an aircraft carrier. He remembered the name Natoma. So his dad went online to the Navy's database and found a carrier called Natoma Bay, which had been stationed in that area of the Sea of Japan in the Second World War. Long story short, they found a huge amount of evidence that supported James's story about having been shot down in a particular battle there at that time. They managed to track down some of his squadron mates who were still alive, who confirmed his story. His parents took him to a reunion of the surviving members of the squadron. And James remembered some of them, one by his voice alone.
Wow.
And said he was very sad because everyone looked so old. They also tracked down James Houston's surviving sister and introduced young James to her. And she confirmed everything that he had said about their family, including the fact that their father had been an alcoholic and other details about family history. So this is one of the most well-supported modern cases of reincarnation on record. I treat it very succinctly in my book, but there's a wonderful book called Soul Survivor, which covers the case in much greater detail. It's a really good read too. There are a number of books that I recommend in my book. And one of the things that I say and recommend to people is that they read very widely. You know, don't just limit it to my book. There are many books out there, focus on the afterlife in one way or another. I mean, if you go to Amazon, search books and type in afterlife, and 20,000 results come up. You know, this is nothing new under the sun here.
No, not indeed.
And you know, some of these books are fictional and so on, but a good many of them are personal accounts of experiences, accounts of scientific research into these questions and so forth. And I say in my book, you know, don't believe me. This, I'm not trying to start a new religion here. You know, I'm just laying out the certain facts as I understand them. And, you know, you go make up your own mind. The worst thing I could do is to start a new religion, believe me. You know, people have to understand these things on their own terms, in their own way, and in the ways that's most meaningful to them. And from that, they can make a start in how they orient themselves to their own life and death. Because everyone, you know, everyone's got their own point of view. I you know, you and I can agree that there's microphones in front of us, but how you perceive your microphone, I have no idea.
I love my microphone. It's annoying. It's a Neumann. It's very nice.
Being
a film guy, you'll understand. You know.
Yes, I do understand.
Neumanns are very nice.
Right, well, but how you perceive that Neumann may be very different from how I do, and there's no way to know because I can't get inside of your head.
On to more serious matters. I know we're kind of wrapping up here, but this is kind of like in 30 seconds or less, give me the meaning of the universe and existence. But in terms of the afterlife, I mean, many people, and I will include myself in this in some ways, you have a fear of death. You have a fear of the unknown, because as much as I do believe that there is an afterlife, and I like to believe that if you've tried to be a decent person in your life, that it's not going to be a horrible thing. You know, I still, there's some old scripts playing back there and some upbringing that I had and things, and many other people, and people think bad things, and bad things are going to go happen, possibly go to hell, or fear of death, or just fear of nothing. You know, the fear of nothing.
Right.
So I guess my question is to you, do we need to have a fear of death? Is it something to not fear, but to understand it's a part of our overall being and a part of the cycle? Where should we fall down on the question of death?
Very good question. We have a little language problem here, because we use the word fear to mean different things. There's our obvious biological fear of death, which is a natural thing. It's part of existing in a physical body. And then there's what we pile on top of that, which is the cultural myths, the emotional, our own emotional reactions to these things, it's helpful to see through that stuff. And, you know, to acknowledge the biological fear, that's just naturally, you know, a survival instinct. It comes with the package. There's no way around that part of it. But we don't need to pile on top of that our abstract fears. And I think there's wisdom in being able to discern one from the other, and also to be aware of how we acquired some of these unnecessary fears from our culture. And, you know, I'm sure you've seen it all. You know, there's the whole tradition of spookiness, you know, which could be great fun on Halloween, but it also, I think, subconsciously affects our attitudes towards life and death. So again, I'm not trying to pass judgments here. I'm just saying that our culture contains a lot of booby traps or buried mines here and there in our language, in our concepts, in the stuff we all assume about life and death. And I think each of us has a responsibility to get beyond that, however we do it in our own way, whether it's acknowledging that we've had so-called paranormal experiences, communications from loved ones who've passed, or whether we've read books that have inspired us to look further, by, you know, whatever means. Everyone has their own, you know, leanings in this regard. I just think it's wise to keep this in mind and to realize that what we know is not all there is to know. I think that's very important to realize. And so if we need to be skeptical about anything, I think we need to be skeptical about our fears and realize that they're not bigger than we are.
And the funny thing is, most of the time in life when I feared something, it wasn't as bad as I thought it would be. Most times. I mean, there can be things, but I mean, times you build stuff up in your mind. And I'm just always so curious if you think about some of the last words of different people who have passed, famous people like Thomas Edison. I think he said something like, "It's very beautiful over there." Steve Jobs, "Oh, wow, oh, wow, oh, wow." And yes. The list goes on and on. I'm probably forgetting about many, and you're just wondering what they have seen. It's just a fascinating subject.
The great composer, Johann Sebastian Bach, is reputed to have said on his deathbed, "Do not cry for me, for I go where music comes from."
Well, that's a great thought. Our guest today has been Daniel Drayson. The book is A New Science of the Afterlife, Space, Time, and the Consciousness Code. And we've only scratched the surface with him. Daniel, where can people find the book, more information about your film work, everything you do? What places would you direct them to?
Well, for the book, Amazon, obviously. They can also go to my website, dandrasin.com. That's dandrasin.com. You can see some of my professional work there as well. But if you click on the menu header, New Science, you'll see the information about the book. And if you scroll down, you'll be able to see my two documentaries. One is called SCOLE, The Afterlife Experiment, which was an experiment done in the 1990s in physical mediumship that's a complete mind blower. And the other documentary is Calling Earth, and that's about afterlife communication through electronics.
Excellent. Well, it's been a really enjoyable conversation, and I hope that people will continue exploration into all of your work. Thank you so much for joining us today on the program.
Thank you so much, Jim. It's been a pleasure.
It certainly has been a pleasure for us as well, and we thank you so much for tuning in today to The Other Side, and I hope that you will continue to explore those mysteries. We'll talk to you next time. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye.